Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silly Cast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, September 21st, 2014, and this is show number 489. Well, before we dig in, I'd like to take a quick second to ask if you enjoy the show, or even if you have ideas for improvement, that you might pop over to iTunes and leave a quick review. It actually makes a big difference in podcasting if we get a lot of reviews, and many people don't realize that you can actually post a new review every year. Maybe you've done it before, but it's been a while, or maybe you've always meant to do it but never got around to it. Today would be a lovely day to type in a word or two and pick the number of stars you think the show deserves. Many thanks to all of you who've done this before and those who plan to do it in the future. Well, I'm sure by now each of you either has a new iPhone, are waiting for a new iPhone, or are never getting the new iPhone, and in any case, are really tired of the conversation about which one to buy. So I'm not going to add to it. iMore recently did a poll of their readers asking which iPhone people were intending to buy, and at the point when I checked, they had 315 votes. The answer was split almost exactly 50-50. Technically, it was 49.3% wanted the iPhone 6 and 50.7% wanted the iPhone 6 Plus. I thought that was actually fascinating. That means no one can tell you which one you're going to like, so we don't need to keep endlessly droning on about which one is better. With that aside, I thought it might be fun to chat a bit about a few unusual things that I found with my iPhone 6 and iOS 8. First of all, the iPhones have always come in distinctive boxes. Now they come in a white label box that simply says iPhone. On the back, they've applied stickers to identify in teeny print which model it is, and in slightly bigger print, how much storage you have. In really tiny print, it says the color. This might not sound like an important deal, but I like to sell my devices later, you know, all pretty like with the original box and packaging and everything. How am I going to tell my boxes apart? Maybe I got to put stickers on them. Well, let's see, the new iPhones are rounded as we all expected, which is awesome, but I didn't realize that the glass would be rounded on the very edge as well. Makes swiping side to side really swell, but I think it also makes it a bit harder to hit the letters on the edges of the screen. I have one password that has a lot of the letter A in it, and I have to really concentrate and hold when I hit the A to make sure it gets recognized. Or maybe it's just me being lame. I'd be curious if anybody else has noticed this. I love statistical data with large sample sets to prove a point, but that doesn't keep me from drawing conclusions without a lot of data. In my very limited use of 3 days, I think the battery life rocks on this thing. By the way, I do have the iPhone 6. I don't know if I mentioned that, not the 6 Plus. I went for a walk with 35% left on the battery. I listened to podcasts for a 53-minute walk, and when I got back, I had 31% left. It used 4% of my battery to listen almost for an hour. Now, I know for a fact my iPhone would have been below 10% after that length of time of listening. Yesterday, I went to bed, I had 33% left on the phone without having charged it all day. That was with well over an hour of podcast and listening, an awful lot of games of 2048, and in general, having a blast with my phone all day. Let's see, next up, I was really hoping to go skinless on this phone because it's so pretty. Yesterday, I was sitting down with the phone in my pocket of my tailored shorts. I stood up, and it flipped right out, face down on the concrete. Shockingly, it was fine. I sent a note to my two kids, for whom I had also bought iPhone 6s, and they both wrote back that they too had both dropped theirs. My daughter's was fine, but unfortunately my son Kyle's had a crack in the screen. I was really, really sad for him. After just getting it, I couldn't bear the idea of him having a cracked iPhone, so this afternoon the two of us went over to Apple to have a chat. There was a line of about 45 people out front and no Genius Bar appointments until Tuesday, but I spoke to the woman at the entrance and I explained the situation. I started by saying I had just bought 3 devices at full price and that all 3 of us had dropped them within the first couple days, but only 2 of us were lucky. Kyle showed her his cracked iPhone. She asked, "Do you have AppleCare?" And I said, "No, but my plan was to buy it on all 3 phones today after getting his fixed." She gave us a sly grin and said, "Hang on." She went away for just a minute or two and came back with a Genius, and they explained that because it was so early after getting it, they're going to take pity on us, and they handed him a new iPhone for free. Then he said they won't even use up one of the 2 repairs you get out of AppleCare. I thought at least they would do that. So Kyle and I bought leather cases for our phones, too. And they let me buy AppleCare on Lindsay's phone, even though it was in San Diego, because they reasoned, if it was broken, you would have told us, because you told us that one was broken. Apple customer service wins one more time. We were astonished. Really, really happy about that. By the way, the guy told me not to tell anybody, but I explained to him I was a podcaster, and he said, all right, go ahead. Just don't use my name. Well, I haven't played very much with the new camera yet, which seems kind of odd for me, but it's only been a couple of days. But I did take a photo with the front-facing camera indoors, but pretty well lit by sunlight from the windows. And it was amazing. So clear and sharp. I would definitely use the front-facing camera now where I used to shun it. I took another one in a dark room with the blinds pulled, and while of course not nearly as good, it was not nearly as grainy as the iPhone 5S's front-facing camera. I'm sorry, iPhone 5's front-facing camera. Now, that makes sense because they said they improved the light gathering of the front-facing camera on the iPhone. I did do a little slow-mo video with a 240 frames per second camera, and it was of Tesla catching a Frisbee, but I haven't had a chance to process it yet, but boy, is that fun. I'm afraid my friends are going to see a lot of videos of Tesla. Get ready. Here's another interesting point. Do you realize that the 128 gigabyte iPhone 6 Plus is $50 more than the 128 gigabyte 11-inch MacBook Air? Seriously, that bad boy is $950 full price when you can get a MacBook Air for $900. Something to think about. Maybe it's how bikinis are more expensive than giant boy bathing suits. I don't know. I gotta say, bottom line on the phone, I really, really like the new iPhone 6. I also love how Apple comes out with the new OS a few days before the new phones. I like it because everybody gets something new and shiny to play with that way. As much as the new hardware amazes and delights, I think half of my enjoyment might be because of iOS 8 itself. It's not all happiness and joy for me, though. Let's start with the happiness and joy, though. I am digging these new keyboards. But before I get into them too far, I should say I really love the predictive text pop-ups on the regular iOS keyboard. I thought it would be distracting, but I'm pretty sure it's way faster for me than typing, pecking away. I start typing and it tells me the word and I just hit the autofill. At least on the tiny iPhone screen, that's true. On the iPad, I'm pretty good at typing with that because it's got such a bigger keyboard. The first phone I ever saw this capability on, by the way, was a BlackBerry, but I'm delighted still that it's come to iOS. Next up, I added the Swipe keyboard that's S-W-Y-P-E. It's a dollar in the App Store. I really wanted to try out this method of typing where you just swipe your finger around on the keyboard and it magically figures out what you meant to type. So you swirl it around and then you lift between words. Swipe works pretty well, but it did one thing I don't like. When it got close to the right word, I couldn't just back up a letter or two to fix it. It would delete the entire word when I hit one delete key. It's not huge, though. And I do really like that it offers to learn words, which is pretty cool. I taught it NoSilicast right away. Later on, I found out that the keyboard SwiftKey is actually free, so I threw that one on there, too. I like SwiftKey better because it lets me correct words more easily. If you want to have your unique words saved so they work on other devices, you'll have to authorize SwiftKey to be allowed to put them in the cloud, which you may or may not want to do depending on your privacy threshold. I said yes. I thought I was going crazy later in the week, though, because I was on my iPad and SwiftKey stopped working properly. I could still type by pecking, but gone was the wonderful swiping, which was why I wanted the keyboard. I uninstalled and reinstalled it, and still no joy. Then I went on their website and I discovered swiping isn't yet supported on the iPad. At least I wasn't going nuts. Another thing I don't like about the swipe keyboard on the iPhone is that it uses a couple of extra keystrokes to get to the keyboard switcher, which is kind of annoying because I'm running a whole lot of keyboards right now. Another thing I'm really happy with is dictation, and iOS 8 rocks. Now, my friend Dan told me recently that he never uses the keyboard. He only dictates into his phone. I had limited success with it before, but with iOS 8, it's a lot better. On iOS 7, when you were talking to it, the typing field stayed empty until you hit done, and only then would it reveal what it thought you said. With iOS 8, it shows you real-time what it thinks you're saying, and you can even see it back up and correct things based on context. Its accuracy appears to be way up, too. Now we have cooler keyboards, and maybe we don't even always need the keyboards to type, so that's just awesome. I think we've caught up to Android here, finally. A non-obvious feature of Messages is that you can pop in videos and audio clips and photos right into the thread without much work. Tap the photo button and slide up and the photo just jumps right into the stream. Many fewer taps, which could be dangerous because it just jumps in there. I think my favorite feature, though, is as a recipient, it works a lot better. I have to explain, I had a 16 gigabyte iPhone before, so I've been struggling with saving space, and my messages were full of videos and photos that are really hard to delete. With the new messages, when you view a photo or video that has been inserted in the way I just described, you get red letters under it that says keep or expires in 2 minutes. If you let it expire, it just leaves your phone. Sort of like a half Snapchat that way. All right, enough joy for now, though. Some things are feeling pretty buggy to me in iOS 8. They feel kind of beta-ish. And, you know, I was on the beta, and I forgave a lot of stuff because of that. But now that I'm in the real delivered iOS 8, I'm not sure about some of these things. So I got to tell you, if you're on the fence about whether it's time to upgrade, listen up. It's only a couple of things I've found so far, but it's still weird. I might have overdone the number of keyboards I put on. Once I had 5 of them in there, things started to get weird. I've had more than one occasion where no keyboard at all appears, and there's no option to flip one up. I had to actually quit the application I was in and go back in to get the keyboard to come back. Secondly, both my iPhone and iPad have awakened, zoomed in so far I can't see anything on screen. In fact, it took me a little while to figure out why. What was I even looking at? It was just like this blurry area, and it was the way they blur the background for you in iOS. So I didn't even know where I was. So I'm trying to answer the phone. I can't answer the phone because all I got is a big blank screen that's kind of blurry one color. I eventually remembered the 3-finger tap and got them back. But that wasn't quite what I was looking for. Several times when I use Spotlight to search for an app, if I misspell the name of the app, like I get partway through spelling Skitch, for example, I spell it S-K-I-T, I can see Skitch come up, but then if I hit the wrong letter next, Skitch disappears like it should. I erase that one letter, and now nothing comes back at all. Like, it's like, phew, I don't know. And I delete all the characters, type them in again correctly this time, and it doesn't come up. I have to go out and back in to get something to come up. That's kind of hinky. My iPad is not obeying Do Not Disturb. It is dinging away constantly. I have the volume turned all the way down, and it's still ding, 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 ding. And I don't even know. It's not even bringing stuff up on screen. It's dinging about something, and I don't even know what it is. If somebody knows how to fix this one, I really want to hear about it. Well, that's going to end my diatribe and discovery for now. In any case, I'm having a blast both with the new iPhone 6 and especially iOS 8. Over the years, you've heard me complain about the Drobo for a very long time, and it's really not the fault of the Drobo itself. Steve and I bought a Drobo FS many years ago, but I didn't think we really needed it. I felt like we succumbed to the convincing advertising of our podcasting friends. I didn't think we had a problem for it to solve. I have to admit now, though, after a few years, Steve and I have both started to use it quite a bit. I offload things that I don't need to be local, like my old uncompressed audio files of the show, which I probably never will need, but you never know, so it's nice to be able to keep them out there. I keep disk images of OS installers on there. I also have started scanning in bills and such, and I don't want those things on my laptop, so the Drobo's a nice spot for it. Steve does a lot of video editing using Final Cut Pro 10, and he was never able to save his project files because they're huge. These are basically uncompressed files. He started saving them when he realized he had gobs of space over on the Drobo. So I have to admit that over time, a soft spot in my heart has grown for the Drobo. Over the past couple of years, we've had 3 hard drive failures, and it's actually rather pleasing to get an email notification to see and then go see a red light on one drive. You simply pull it out and you replace it with a new drive and await the notification from Drobo that now all is well. Now, I'd rather not have hard drive failures, but it wasn't ever catastrophic because the Drobo just like they say, it's just beautiful. You just plug it in and it's just a wonderful thing. Now, the Drobo FS that we bought is, however, notoriously slow. It takes forever to mount a share, which looks like a folder to the user, and the Drobo dashboard app is also slow to connect. I'd never measured the speed of moving files to it, but as soon as Dave Hamilton told me it was slow, then it really started to bother me. Fast forward to now, and Dave and macOS Ken are advertising the Drobo 5N, their new network-attached 5-bay unit. And Dave says it's fast, so Steve and I started to get the itch to upgrade. But we really had no excuse to do this, no problem to solve, as they might say. Steve adroitly pointed out, though, that since the files we store on the Drobo do not exist anywhere else, it's technically not a backup. I didn't realize, by the way, that in addition to his uncompressed video project, he's now storing all of his finished videos only on the Drobo. Now, these files are protected from the most likely disaster, so in a way it's like a half a backup, that of a hard drive failure. So in that sense, they are a backup. But what if the controller for the Drobo went out? We could potentially lose all of the data. This did happen to a friend of ours, and he ended up sending it back to Drobo, and they were able to reconstruct the data, but we'd sure rather not go through all of that. Luckily, now we'd rationalize their decision to buy a new Drobo 5N. Steve ordered the 5N, and we actually bought it directly through Amazon, not using one of the affiliate links. So I made a point to write to Drobo to tell them that Dave Hamilton, Mac OS Ken, had talked a lot about the Drobo 5N, and that's why we bought it, and so that they got their advertising chops. But we got a better price, actually, directly through Amazon. And so now it was time to choose some drives. We found an article over at Backblaze.com, and there's a link in the show notes. It's Backblaze is one of the online backup companies, so they buy a gazillion drives, right? And remember I talked earlier about liking a lot of good statistics that were actually statistically significant because of the sample size? Well, they outlined their experiences with drive failure rates. Now, remember I mentioned we'd had three drive failures. I'm pretty sure two of the three were Seagate's, with the third being Western Digital. I'd always assumed it was like most things. You can have a bad experience, but it's just random. You know what they say? There's two kinds of hard drives, the kind that have failed and the kind that will fail. But in fact, according to Backblaze, the failure rates on drives from Seagate are 3 to 4 times more prevalent than on Western Digital drives. Even more impressive are the Hitachi failure rates. Where Seagate is as high as 14% annual failures, Western Digital's are at 3%, and Hitachi comes in at around 1.5% to 2%. I put a link in the show notes to the article so you can read their analysis for yourself and see exactly how they figured all this out, but this data pushed us to buy Hitachi drives from a third party to populate the new Drobo. Now, we are not thinking that these drives will never fail or will last forever. They could fail tomorrow like any other drive, but we figured we were hedging our bets with going with Hitachi. Now, there's one more decision point. With the Drobo 5N, you can choose to also buy an mSATA SSD to implement what they call hot data caching. Evidently, this is supposed to speed up data access, and since that was one of our main complaints, we threw in that SSD. By the way, this mSATA SSD goes in the Drobo accelerator bay, which is a small slot in the bottom of the unit, so it still leaves 5 bays open for normal disks. When the new Drobo arrived, Merry Christmas, Steve, by the way, I suggested, why don't we run some speed tests? We know the Drobo FS is slow, so it would be fun to compare, and again, to continue rationalizing our purchase. We read online that while you can move your drives from the FS to the 5N, you'll only get partial speed improvement if you do that. The real speed comes when you put in all new drives in the 5N. I thought it would be cool to measure that difference too. So the plan was to test read and writes to the old FS with its drives, then the 5N with the old drives, then copy the data to the 5N on new drives and run the speed test a third time. That would be cool data, right? Steve popped open the 5N and he put the drives from the older FS into the 5N. And he started to run speed tests. But he noticed that the 5N was doing a fair bit of chunking away on those drives. He had a sudden horrid thought. What if the 5N was somehow optimizing those drives for its own use? Not overwriting them or anything, but maybe they wouldn't work in the FS when he was done. He called Drobo and they confirmed, yep, those old drives can't just be slapped back into the FS. Well, this isn't as bad as losing the data, but we just dropped close to $1,000 on this new unit with all the new drives. We want to put the new drives in it. We don't want to put the old drives in it, how do we get the data out of it? So, I should mention, we only have about 2.8 terabytes of data on the Drobo right now. So I dashed off to the store and I bought an external 3 terabyte backup drive. I figured worst case, we could send this to a friend's house later and we'll have an offsite storage of what we have on the Drobo. So now realize what we have to do to fix this problem. So we've got the data on the old drives in the new unit. So we have to copy the data from the Drobo 5N to the external drive. Then we have to move the original old disks back to the FS. We have to reformat them over there, put the new drives in the 5N, and then copy the data back from the backup drive to the new 5N. And then, in the end, what we wanted to do was keep the FS to do backups of the 5N, so we have to configure a backup program, probably super duper, to start backing up the 5N to the old FS. So we are going to move the data, let's see, from the FS to the backup drive, that's once, from the backup drive to the new drives in the FS, that's two, or in the 5N, that's two. And then from the 5N back to the, yeah, three times. We're going to move 3 terabytes 3 times. Now, as much fun as that sounds, it gets a little bit worse. Steve's iMac is the logical one to do all this nonsense copying back and forth. But the poor dear, you know, he only has 8 cores, a terabyte drive, an SSD, and 3.4 gigahertz i7 in this 27-inch iMac, but it does not have USB 3. He keeps complaining about that. Anyway, so it's slower than if we used my MacBook Pro, but I'm not willing to tether my laptop for the next week or three while we do this. He's also on Wi-Fi. We could hardwire him, but I think our Wi-Fi network is faster than USB 2.0. I also remembered that the cable we used to connect the Drobo to the Drobo room years ago is Cat 5, so it's actually only 100 base T, so it's not even gigabit Ethernet. So we dragged a Cat 6 cable down the hall to the gigabit switch, so at least that's not the limiter there. Now he's seeing peaks of 240 megabits per second read and writes, so I think we're doing okay for now. I think we're past halfway now getting the data across. And in the meantime, Steve has bought one of these dongles, a little dock things. They call them docks, but it's Thunderbolt on one side, and it's going to give him a couple of USB 3 ports and gigabit Ethernet there, which he already has, but he'll have another one. Anyway, that should help the speed when we start moving it back the other way. But anyway, I expect you're going to hear more about all of this during the next week. I've really been enjoying how much it's made people nuts that I, A, bought a Windows phone, and B, that I actually like it. Part of my reason for enjoying it has been the constant help of Joel Rushworth, who I met through Chris Ashley of the SMR podcast. Joel is not pushy at all, but he's just there with a gentle suggestion, the helpful hint, and the, hey, have you tried this yet? A week ago or so, he asked me if I'd move my SIM card from my iPhone to my Nokia 635 so I could give it a real shakedown and use it as my primary device. So this was before the iPhone 6 got here, and that seemed like a good time as any to do that. But I told him I hadn't, because the iPhone uses a nano SIM, and the Nokia takes a micro SIM card. He showed me, or he told me that he was buying some of the little adapter carrier things, and he'd be happy to send me one when he got his. Good as his word, the adapter showed up a few days later. During one of the endless podcasts I was on last week, I shouldn't complain, I loved every minute of it, but man, I did a lot of podcasting last week, I used a paperclip to pop out the nano SIM on my iPhone. The adapter carrier thing from Joel was a little piece of plastic the shape of a micro SIM, but with a pocket in it the shape and size of a nano SIM. Let's just call it an adapter for brevity. I laid my iPhone SIM in the adapter and popped off the back of the Nokia. I should mention that the Nokia doesn't feel like it needs a case at all. The back feels kind of like a case and pops off without too much effort. Under the case is the battery, which is easy to remove as well. Then there was a little metal piece that was obviously where the micro SIM was supposed to slide in. I slid in the adapter, put the battery back, popped the back on, booted it up, and Bob's your uncle, the Nokia 635 was a full-fledged phone on AT&T. Of course, this was an idiotic thing to do while on a podcast because shortly after that, someone called me and instead of being in do not disturb mode like I always do with my iPhone, the Nokia rang away happily. Anyway, proof of concept complete, I reversed the process with the full intention of giving it another go when I had some time to dedicate to really thinking out using the Nokia full time for that week. The only problem was that I had this tiny little plastic adapter and I was afraid I'd lose it. I had a brilliant idea. I opened up the Nokia and put the adapter into the little connector without the SIM card in it. Put the battery back in and I replaced the back and I knew that adapter would be safe. I would never lose it. Yeah, it turned out to be a really dumb idea. The next day I was ready to do another experiment with the Nokia and the nano SIM for my iPhone. When I went to pull the little adapter out, it wouldn't slide back out. I pulled gently, then firmly, and then with a little bit more emphasis, but it would only slide in and out a full few millimeters. Steve is pretty good with electronics too, so I enlisted his help. He pushed and pulled a bit, and then he figured out what the problem was. Remember I said I had to flip over the adapter so the nano SIM was on the underside of the adapter and that it fit into a little pocket? Well, when you slide it in, there are 3 pins that push up against the nano or micro SIM to make the hard physical contact. With no SIM in there at all, the 3 pins pushed up into the pocket of the adapter, catching it so that we couldn't pull it out. We're nothing if not resourceful. All we needed was something stiff enough, thin enough, and narrow enough to slide in under the adapter to push those pins back so we could slide out the adapter. I think the kind of shims you used in the old days to catch, to check the gap on the points in your carburetor would have been just perfect. But I'm pretty sure we don't have those anymore. Heck, I don't think we have carburetors anymore, do we? I had a very old metal ruler that would slide almost in. It was thin enough so we knew it would work, but it was too wide so we could only go at an angle and we couldn't catch all the pins. We festered on this for a day or so and then decided, on Joel's advice, to just take the phone apart. No problem, I've got a full set of Torx drivers. But our drivers went down to T6, and this required a T4. Steve went out and bought me a really cool driver set that went down to T4 along with some other nice drivers just to keep in my electronics kit. Either way, I'm ahead so far, right? I got new tools. We took out every screw we could find, and just like always happens on this kind of thing, we could get it to pull apart, but not along one edge. Doesn't that always happen? Our buddy Ron came over for dinner, who is also quite clever in this arena, and no matter how many gin and tonics we had, we could not figure out how to get this thing apart. The next day, I went on to iFixit looking for a teardown. I found a lot of Nokias, but none had the exact same problems that I was looking for. Off to Twitter again and help yet again from Joel, who came to my rescue. He found a teardown for another Nokia and it had the tiny little trick to fix the problem. When you look at the two pictures in the show notes after hearing this explanation, you'll think we were all idiots or had too much gin, but we never would have for a second would have found out the problem. What looked like a solid case was actually a piece of very firmly applied black tape. Pull up the tape and voila, a nice little screw underneath. All right, finally we got the phone apart. And we had little more access to the SIM slot than when we started. I left the phone open for a few days on the kitchen counter, just hoping for some inspiration, looking at it every time I walked by, thinking how to get that darn adapter out. Then one day, Steve pulled his car out of the garage, giving me an unobstructed view of our pegboard of tools. I just stood there, looking at clamps, electrical tape, saws, there's got to be something. Wait, jigsaw blades! Yes, jigsaw blades are much narrower than my ruler, but they're still nice and thin. Now, of course, I wouldn't shove the saw end into the SIM card slot, but the end that goes into the saw was a nice little rectangular end. I dashed over the phone, and I slid in the jigsaw blade. It turned out I had to jiggle it around a bit because it was actually a little too narrow now, so it would only depress two of the three pins. Got it at the right angle, got it to push down all three pins, I grabbed the adapter and pulled, and out it popped. My victory was not to last, though, because along with the SIM card adapter, out popped one of the three pins. What I didn't think about was that the jigsaw blade had holes in it, one of which nicely grabbed hold of that pin and ripped it right out for me. Well, I guess the good news is that I reassembled the Nokia, and other than not being a phone anymore, it works perfectly. I've now given you instructions on how exactly to turn a Nokia 635 smartphone into a Nokia 635 Touch. You guys probably think I make all these stories up, but I use Clarify all the time. This week, my friend Marianne wanted to know how to figure out if her MacBook Air had the necessary hardware to support the new handoff feature in iOS 8 and Yosemite. Handoff is a feature that will allow us to start an email on our Macs and then finish as we walk away using our iOS devices. It also works between iOS devices. It's one of the big magic integrations so many of us are so excited about. However, you do have to have Bluetooth 4.0 low energy, also known as Bluetooth LE. I was pretty sure I knew how to figure it out, but I did a bit of the Googles to verify. None of the sites I looked at showed graphically how to point and click to quickly find the answer. Instead, they relied on long, drawn-out explanations. So I whipped open Clarify, took two entire screenshots, dropped in a couple of rounded rectangles, an arrow, and maybe I threw in 20 words of text. I tapped on edit, copy document to clipboard, flip back to her email, and I hit paste. I knew there'd be no questions, no misunderstanding of my instructions, and she'd have the answer to her question. I think that's the real beauty of Clarify. It's not just that it's easy and fun to make the instructions, it's that you only make them once. No follow-up questions, no clarifying questions, if you will. If you love helping people, it's great. If you hate helping people, it's even better because you get them out of your hair and you don't have to talk to them anymore. Either way, it's great. Go check out the free trial of Clarify over at clarify-it.com. Oh, and the little tutorial I made for Marianne to find out if your Mac will do handoff is available at a link in the show notes. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond, and I'm pretty excited to have a new guest on the show. His name is Ian Douglas, and you've actually heard him before. You probably remember him as the guy who ends his recordings with an idea worth sharing. Ian's been a photographer from the time his dad gave him a camera. I think he started at age 4. He's interested in astronomy, so I guess he must like everything Bart talks about, radio and aviation, so there's something for our aviation crowd. And he eventually found computers as his passion in high school. He's recently gone back to university, and he's getting a master's in computer science, and he's interested in security and focusing on connected vehicle communications, which is going to be the source of our conversation today. He just attended the 21st Intelligent Transportation System 2014 World Congress in Detroit, and he was so excited, he demanded to be on Chit Chat Across the Pond. How are you doing today, Ian?
Pretty good, Allison. How about you?
I'm doing good. I'm excited about this. I know you have a good voice and a great microphone, and you seem to be interesting. So whatever you want to talk about, I'm cool with that.
Well, I was really impressed that this World Congress came to Detroit this year. It's a real timely thing because my master's thesis is starting, and I wanted to get these contacts. I had not noticed these folks before. They started meeting in Paris in 1994. I can't believe they've been having that kind of a congress for 21 years.
So there have been intelligent transportation for 21 years?
They're claiming of one form or another that they've been needing to get together like this and get the experts at things for that long.
If you look at little things like the ability to tell the pressure in your tires or something, that's kind of smart. You know, little pieces that have come along the way, right?
And electronic toll collection. There's a few different systems like that that people just wanted to do things. We've got cameras getting installed all over the place now. There is just an awful lot happening out there with connecting transportation management systems and information to drivers.
Right, right. So this Congress, this Transportation World Congress, has been all over the world?
They started off in Paris in 1994. They were in Tokyo last year. Next year is scheduled for Bordeaux, France, then Melbourne, Australia, and Montreal in 2017.
Wow. Wow. You're from Canada yourself, correct?
Yep. I live just south of Detroit.
Okay. All right. Well, we're practically homies then, huh?
That's right, yeah.
So you were excited about this because this is relevant to your studies. What did you learn about the future of where transportation, intelligent transportation, is going?
Well, we all think about the future, and we've seen clips back from when General Motors was doing tests in the 50s, and all the cars look like jets, and we're all thinking
George Jetson, right?
Exactly, that's the thing.
Where's my flying car?
Well, and people want to push a button and have it take them there, and I guess Google kind of got people's attention earlier this year in the last couple of years with their autonomous vehicles.
But they're not the only ones doing autonomous vehicles. They're just kind of the loudest and most exciting.
Which is normal for Google, right?
Sure. Right, right.
So it's really interesting because that's not exactly what we're going to end up with.
We're not going to end up with self-driving cars?
Maybe, eventually. But near future, stuff that you and I will know in the next 10 years, not quite.
Okay. So what kind of stuff are we looking at?
So right now, in the very near future, your car's not going to only be able to talk to other cars. It's going to also be able to talk to traffic lights and other roadside devices.
Wait, so it's going to talk to other cars?
That's what they're going to get implemented for us.
Okay. I assume later on you're going to tell us why my car would want to talk to your car?
Well, that's the no-silicast question, the whole benefit thing, right? What are we doing and why?
Right, right.
We definitely will get to the problem to be solved.
Okay. So you said it's gonna talk to traffic lights and other roadside stuff?
Roadside devices. If there's areas that have dangerous conditions possible, sharp curves or bridges that ice over, that kind of thing. When they get into those situations and they can notify the drivers ahead of time, it'll be beneficial so that they won't scream around corners that are too icy and that kind of thing.
So you could have a corner that ices over, and when it's iced over, it would send the signal, but when it's not iced over, it wouldn't?
That's the idea.
Oh, wow. That's kind of wild.
So it's got a lot of interesting ideas behind this whole thing, but the main background is basically vehicle crashes kill 33,000 Americans annually. It's the leading cause of death for young Americans between 4 and 35 years of age. So our friends over at NHTSA, the Traffic Safety Administration, basically figure that a connected vehicle system will potentially reduce these unimpaired incidents by up to 80%.
Really? Because now I'm not sure I buy that based on just alerting me that there's ice on a corner or something like that, because I you know, I'm not going to listen anyway because I'm an idiot and I'm going to go too fast.
Well, the basic things that they demonstrated during some of the show were the two critical situations that they're finding collisions happen all the time. One is when you've got two vehicles approaching a corner and it's an obstructed view.
Okay.
So you end up with one of the vehicles getting T-boned by the other. And they demonstrated that in some of the driving tests that I was out in one of the vehicles. And it's an amazing thing to see this work in the vehicle.
Well, what do you mean see it work? So you've described a scenario where I'm coming around a corner and I can't see the other guy and I'm going to T-bone him. What does the vehicle do?
It actually has dash lights and audible warnings, and it chirps at you to let you know that there's a potential collision so that you can take action and make sure you don't smack into something. Lets you know to hit the brakes, basically.
Really? Yeah, we had a horrible accident in our family where it was two cars coming up over a hill and there was no center line drawn on the road. And so you're saying this would have told them, hey, there's somebody coming?
The idea is that definitely it would tell you that there is a potential for crash coming because it's going to know your GPS position. It's going to be able to broadcast your position, your direction of travel, your speed, that kind of thing, every second, about 10 times a second.
Okay. But is my car talking to that car yet or in this scenario?
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
So it gets really complicated in a hurry that they've got all these cars talking to each other all the time, and you don't need to know that they're doing it. They're just going to do it, and then when they sense a dangerous situation, they'll notify you.
It does make me wonder, you remember in the old flat network days before we knew how to make subnets, you'd have a printer advertising its services or a computer saying, I need to print, and going to every single device on the network going, are you a printer? Are you a printer? Are you a printer? So you probably don't want that, but if it could do it located, like you say, by GPS within, a 1 mile radius of each other, they talk to each other, because otherwise you don't want all the cars in the world talking to all the cars in the world.
That's a pretty big mesh network, and it would really cause trouble. So you're absolutely right. They call it dedicated short-range communication. And the idea is that it's supposed to be a 300-meter radius. I think that's a little flexible, but so that means that your onboard unit on your car, the OBU, would chat with theirs, but it wouldn't transmit something that was, say, 3 or 4 kilometers away. It would only handle 300 or 400 meters.
Okay, that's about a half a mile in my units for those listeners.
Yeah, half a mile roughly.
Okay. That's all right then. All right.
So that's the basic premise of the basic safety data. And you're right, it's something that if you did a broadcast, and that's basically what these are doing, they're broadcasting where they're at to everybody around them. So if you're within range, your onboard unit is going to have to be listening to potentially a lot of cars to try and figure out, is this a crash potential or not?
Yeah. What about for general traffic problems, like the fact that the cars are stopped ahead?
So each onboard unit's also going to be capable of transmitting so that it will be able to relay messages along to drivers that are farther on down the road. So the oncoming traffic may actually be able to notice that there's a accident and be able to retransmit that kind of a message for oncoming traffic.
I would really like to see that. I know supposedly Waze does that. But I've never gotten the value out of it that the zealots seem to get out of it, that it never seems to be in coordinates I can do anything about. Like I can see on the map that people are going, yeah, I'm only going 5 miles an hour, but I can't tell where that is relative to me. I need a delta that's 5 miles away, or that's 1 mile away or whatever. It never seems to give me quite what I want. I like the idea of it rerouting.
Guys at the US DOT were really pumped about the whole thing with Waze. They love crowdsourced data. They think this is really wonderful, but they need to get it integrated into the intelligent transportation system to provide, as you say, the meaningful data. you need to know some way that, okay, it's 5 miles up and I'm going to be off the road in three.
Right.
You know, I'm not interested in that. Or there's a particular situation, there's a backup that starts 5 miles away, but is it a 3 mile backup already? And it is going to affect the tail end of that backup, would affect your route of travel.
Right, right, right. So, even though you're not going to, you don't need to be at the end of it.
Yeah, you don't even care where the beginning of the accident is. That's for the emergency responders. But you want to know what's a, you know, how do you get around it and not get stuck in traffic?
Yeah, and I don't know. I shouldn't just complain about Waze. I'm going to end up with a bunch of hate mail on that. But getting little cute icons of people who, you know, care about traffic and stuff with their and drawing little pictures of fire engines and that kind of thing. I don't need that. I just want data.
Well,
get off now or you're never getting home tonight.
They have to be able to provide it reliably, and that's part of the problem right now. They're trying to make sure that they have reliable data. They want to make sure that they don't have data that's misrepresenting messages, because if people become annoyed with the system, it's going to be something they just want to turn off.
Yeah. So let's turn corners a little bit here, puns intended. I'm not a crazy privacy person, but this sort of sounds like a lot of data about me is going to get transmitted.
Well, that's a really good point. The designers of these systems really don't want to be traced either. The benefits behind collision avoidance are huge. They had to figure something out. And what they've devised is a clever system, and it's going to use certificates. And we're going to roll through about 1,000 certificates every year. And these certificates are going to be used to mint different pseudonym MAC addresses. And we're going to roll them frequently to prevent the ability for people to track.
Oh, interesting. So I'm one IP address for a while, and I'm one IP, a different IP address for a while?
Well, actually, that's part of it, but they're doing it to the MAC address, which is just a step ahead of your IP address.
Oh, right.
And yeah, so they're a level down from, they're actually
layer
two.
Wait, so they're changing
two.
Your MAC address?
Yeah, they're obfuscating your MAC address. They're going to use pseudonym MAC addresses.
Okay, so for people who don't know what a MAC address is, it has nothing to do with the Macintosh, but a Mac.
Yeah, it's not a NoSilicast MAC thing. It's a media access controller. It's the piece of the hardware that allows you to reliably generate that level 3 connection, the IP connection.
So I always thought that a MAC address was hardwired, if you will, into the firmware of the network adapter.
So like, yes, it is.
I have a MAC address for my Ethernet jack, a MAC address for my Wi-Fi radio, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and your Bluetooth. Everybody's got a MAC address because that's what they do. And
but
of course,
you can actually change that.
Well, that's what they're going to do with these. They're making sure that it's going to do that because they don't want to get tracked either.
Okay, that sounds good.
They do want you to get tracked though if you have an accident, because believe you me, I want EMS and the fire and whoever has to haul my butt out of there to find the pinpoint accuracy of where I'm at.
Yeah. Well, no, because you're not going to be in the accident in the first place.
Well, that's the whole gain of this system. But if something does happen, you know, it'll make it easier for EMS to get there.
So how does this work from a network perspective? I mean, am I going to have to buy a data plan for my car?
Well, there's internet access through some of them, and they call that part WAVE. It's wireless access in a vehicular environment.
They're good at acronyms, aren't they?
Oh, good gosh. They're worse than NASA. I mean, I think what happened is...
Your show notes is like, oh my gosh, there's like 70 acronyms in here.
Well, there is, and it's just crazy. But yeah, I think it's the IEEE, the electrical and electronics engineers designed the specs for this stuff. And you know how it is when you get a whole bunch of people working on a problem, they acronym the heck out of it. So
you betcha.
Basically, the low level stuff is going to be like a Wi-Fi for our cars, and it's going to run on the free Wi-Fi. It's not exactly in the same area.
Wait, what free Wi-Fi?
You know how our Wi-Fi that we use in the house, nobody has to pay for it. It's all running on 5.9 gigahertz, and you know we're using telephones like that.
What do you mean nobody has to pay for it? I'm paying a gazillion dollars to Verizon to have my internet connection. You're saying once I create the Wi-Fi after that?
So for your cellular, communications, they're going to go through the cellular network, and obviously there's charges for that. But if you do the Wi-Fi in the house, there's no charge between your iPad or your MacBook to get to your Wi-Fi access point in your house.
Yeah, but I had to pay for the internet access.
Well, right, but you're only going to be communicating between one car and another. You're kind of making a mesh network where they all talk. So each car will leap to another with no charge because they're all part of the 5.9 gigahertz communications, at least in North America and Europe.
So wait, I'm still lost. So are you saying that my car will create like an ad hoc network? Or
yes, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, and they're all joining each other's ad hoc networks?
Right. They're all vehicular ad hoc networks. That's exactly what this
is. Then how do you connect to several networks at the same time? Because if I'm on the 405 and I got six cars around me, don't I need to connect to all of them?
You do. And the way they do that is they lower it down to just a broadcast message. So you're broadcasting your Macs from layer two, and you don't actually need an IP address. You don't even have to encapsulate anything. You're just talking to everybody. You're in a great big mesh network.
Okay.
So that part of it means that every car is a Wi-Fi access point in some regards.
Okay.
Because the onboard...
They're not on the internet, though. It's just to talk to each other.
Just to talk to each other.
Okay. Okay. Exactly. Now I'm with you. Okay.
But they will get there eventually. So the next part of it is, you know, how do you get out to the communications network? And, of course, there's roadside units involved. So roadside equipment or roadside units. And they will be connected back into the internet. So roughly, you will be able to get information like safety messages that the traffic management systems will be able to transmit back to you, particularly to your area.
In densely populated countries, I could see this working reasonably well, that part of it working reasonably well. But in North America, we got an awful lot of, and certainly in Canada even worse, a lot of areas that are probably... not populated with humans, but not populated with any kind of broadband access, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, Canada's crazy for that.
So you got to wait for that to catch up?
In some ways you do, and in others you don't, because the Crash Avoidance Metrics Partnership, it's a whole group of manufacturers that are together in that. What they wanted to do is make sure that they had the ability for the connected vehicles to at least tell each other if there's something that's a potential crash. So if you've got a truck driving down a road and a car driving down a road opposite directions, they'll tell each other whether or not they're going to crash. So you don't need the internet for that. Right. And that was the big driving factor of this. To get other things like the avoidance of traffic issues, when you're in the unpopulated areas, you're not going to have the same issues. So the internet's not as interesting to them.
I suppose. But you're still going to have icy roads out in Wyoming where there's no people.
Right, but it'll still transmit from the roadside unit in the 5.9 Wi-Fi. It's a zone kind of near Wi-Fi, but it's not. It's a contiguous area just beside what we use for Wi-Fi.
But still, how did the roadside unit get an internet connection? Are you saying it doesn't need one?
Wouldn't need one. It would
just
be able to broadcasting.
Broadcast. Okay.
Yeah. It could have one, and you'd be surprised how far you can get a Wi-Fi signal to go.
How are those going to be powered?
Solar powered, I would imagine, for the most part. Solar to battery, I think, is the method they would have for remote units like that.
Yeah. Yeah. That'd be interesting. Okay. So what's the driver for this? Is there anything in particular that's making this very timely now?
Well, basically, we've got all the technology to implement it today. Wi-Fi is not that difficult for us to understand. We've been using it for a long time. Bluetooth is another option for connections that, you know, we're using every day. So the technology's there. The highway sites and the traffic lights have all got these IP cameras all over the place, too. The traffic management centers for different jurisdictions all want to have all this information. And so they're rolling out internet connections to them, putting IP cameras up, trying to get those traffic feeds back. So the infrastructure is there to support roadside equipment or roadside units. And the dedicated short-range communication is there for traffic management systems. What's happened is now that the manufacturers and the standards groups and the governments are more connected than ever. When I was at the conference, I noticed a traffic management center was set up as a remote, and they were actually doing traffic management work from the Cobo Hall. They even plugged in the Ministry of Transport for Ontario border crossing stuff, and it was just amazing that they were able to do this. But the technology is at the point where we can implement it. The biggest problem has been bureaucracy between governments and jurisdictions on transportation management.
I'm shocked to hear that, Ian. Really? Shocking.
Well,
has part of the bureaucracy been picking standards?
Picking standards has been awful. The draft standards were out and published in 2007, and they're just at the point where they're finally going to mint these standards and say, listen, we're going with this. We'll take, we're going to freeze them and say, this is it.
That work is annoying and detailed, but if you don't do it up front, nothing works, right?
And that's why it's taken so long to get here. We're 7 years after the standards, we're in draft mode, but they've come to the point where the manufacturers can see that it's going to work. Governments are seeing, different bodies of the governments are looking at things and saying, gosh, we have to do this. We have trouble like all these crashes. 33,000 people die every year due to texting. It's the 10% of that other number from before. Distracted driving is just a huge issue. And NHTSA and the USDOT are really pushing to fix all of these problems.
I've said this on here before, but when I heard that it was going to be illegal to text while driving in California, I just assumed that they meant like at stoplights. It never occurred to me that any human on this planet would think that they could drive and do it at the same time. It never occurred to me. So you've got to be kidding me.
Yeah, and if you went to distracted.gov, you'll see a real interesting YouTube video showing a bunch of kids in a car, and all of a sudden, wham. And it just really brings home to you the idea that, things could be very bad very quickly, and it's just because somebody got a text message. So,
yeah, you can make jokes about the Darwin effect, but that has nothing to do with who they hit, right?
Well, that's the problem. It could be somebody was just casually texting, and then they could hit somebody who had no chance. So
how are these systems going to solve that, though? So I'm a moron, and I think that I can text while going 30 miles an hour in a residential district. Let's take little kids off the street, not do that. But there's a car coming. How are these systems going to stop me from being stupid?
Well, they're definitely not going to do that. And one of the big things they don't want to
I guess
take,
that was a tall order.
Well, it's
stop
a huge
my stupid
tall,
behavior.
It's huge to alter everybody's behavior. And a lot of talk came in the conference around the idea of automated vehicles and autonomous vehicles. The idea of the automated vehicle being the connected version of the autonomous vehicle. But what they're saying is they don't want to take control away from the driver yet. It sounds like they're doing this as a marketing thing. They don't want to make people sound like, oh, you don't have to even put a hand on the wheel anymore. You can. It's funny when you're listening to some of the things. The General Motors CEO Mary Barra was up doing a plenary. A keynote speech, mm-hmm. And she was talking about being able to remove your hands from the wheel and let the car drive, on its own.
See,
but
why I think that's the way to go. I mean, just because I got a system that's going to tell me I'm about to kill somebody in another car doesn't mean I'm going to successfully react to that.
Well, and I think eventually, maybe in the 50-year time frame, we'll get there. But in the near term, Bill Ford was out talking about autonomous vehicles and the aging population, and he says we don't want to leave anybody behind. He's worried that we're going to try and automate this thing to the point where people don't understand it. And so his point was that, we can't necessarily prevent people from doing things that are dumb, but we can alert the other drivers around them so that they'll have a chance of getting out of it.
Give us a fighting chance.
That's the whole deal.
Interesting. Interesting. I guess, I don't know. I want them to go farther. I mean, I don't know how to fly the plane, and I'm okay somebody else is flying it. But and actually, most of the time, that's on autopilot, and I'm perfectly okay with that.
Yeah, the autopilots work great.
Because, I mean, looking at things that machines are better at than us, I don't know. I think mostly it's a psychological problem that a lot of people seem to think that they're the ones who can do a better job driving than a machine. They do not believe that the machine could be better than them. I think those people are idiots.
I got to tell you, I would sign up for an automated vehicle right now if I could. I think the idea is wonderful that, you know, you could sit back and read the paper on your way into work. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Oh, it'd be great. It'd be great. And I shouldn't say they're idiots. I should say I think they're delusional.
I don't mind getting out for a nice ride in the, you know, put the top down and get the sunny day and just enjoy yourself. But, you know, for the normal commute where it's the grind and it's the rough weather and the, you know, having to deal with traffic snarl ups and everything, it's not quite the same as your weekend, you know, your weekend drive.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's hardly any pleasure driving around here where I live because I'm in LA, you know?
Yeah, that's...
It took me 25 minutes to get to the gym the other day, and I think it's not quite 7 miles.
Yeah, and that's if you can get to the highway. I know in Toronto they have an awful time. It's worse than some of the traffic I've seen in LA, and that's doing some. But they actually have total gridlock for several hours of the day, starting from about 10 till about 4 in sections of the 401 highway there. It's just ridiculous.
And the other thing is, I think what a lot of people don't realize is if you can have a lot of this stuff automated, that you're going to have fewer accidents, you're going to have less traffic than you had before because the inconsistency of human drivers would be eliminated.
Well, you'll get them, especially trucks and that kind of thing, staying to a lane and staying in tandem with each other. And they'll actually do something called platooning where they try and stay within close range of each other. And what happens is, I was really surprised to find this out at the conference, the guy who's in the lead, we always used to think that if you drafted up too close to him, that you were causing him extra gas, you know, he'd be burning extra gas, pulling you along behind him. The guy in the lead would actually end up with 7% less fuel consumption because of the drag that he's not having to deal with behind his truck.
Because the turbulence that was normally just waste.
Right.
Is actually so, getting used. Interesting.
Exactly. And so what happens is you'll be able to platoon 4 or 5 trucks and large transport trailers together. The guy at the tail end gets about a 12 to 15% savings in fuel. The guys in the middle get a savings in fuel. And the guy at the front is about a 7% savings.
Wow.
So.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, they're looking at a lot of different aspects of this and trying to figure out, does it make sense? And boy, it is just super interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So, but you can only do that when you can depend on the fact that that guy in front is not going to hit somebody in front of them. That
or you know to brake at the same time he does.
You're back on relying on that human I don't trust, Ian. Just because you told me to brake doesn't mean I wasn't turning around on my seat grabbing a sandwich out of the back seat.
Well, we like you said, we can't prevent the natural selection problem, but...
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So what else is going on in this?
Well, you know... There's an advanced notice of proposed rulemaking, and once again, a great acronym, the ANPRM from NHTSA. They're basically going to have us requiring this technology in new cars in the very near future. And I'm thinking it'll be within 5 years you're going to hear that this is a requirement on vehicles.
In what countries?
North America.
So this was a global world congress, but it was focused on North America? That doesn't seem right.
It wasn't only focused on North America. The European Telecommunications Standards Institute was well represented. So I had an opportunity to meet the director or the chairman of that board. I've met people from Japan who are implementing this system over there. They're moving a little bit different because they've already got electronic toll collection going on in 5.9, so they can't do it the same exact way we are. They're going to use 700 megahertz. There's just a ton of work going on.
Okay.
It's just amazing to see what's...
So you're saying in North America, cars will have to have this built in. What happens to me if I got an old car then?
That's
participate?
The beauty of this system is that North American cars since 96 all have onboard diagnostics ports, and basically they have a CAN bus. So that like the idea behind a CAN bus, and you may have several... In your vehicle, but it makes it easy to plug stuff in. And so
I've heard of onboard diagnostics. That's the OBD port.
Right.
What's a CAN bus?
So that's what the OBD, the onboard diagnostics port, plugs into is the CAN bus, and it's
okay.
So it's a controller area network vehicle bus, and you may have gateways between them, and your vehicle could have up to five of these CAN buses in it. They've had to put them in because it's so simple to connect stuff in your CAN bus on your car that it'll just recognize it immediately and start, you know, providing signals. You may not want them crossing signals unless you gateway things, but going to mean that it's an easy thing. You can just plug in and get diagnostics information out of the CAN bus.
So today, for those people who don't know what this onboard diagnostics bus is, I know about it because Honda Bob taught me, is he walks up with a little gizmo that he just shoves into this OBD port, and it tells him, oh, you've got, you know, this little part has failed in the car. So it's doing onboard diagnostics, like it says. But it's basically just a connector that talks to the electronics in the car that's monitoring what's going on with it. And you're saying we could plug into that, plug a unit into that that would then give me this broad or 700 megahertz signal capability and all that?
It would plug into the CAN bus. It would be just like the OBD port does to have access to the information in the system. So it wouldn't necessarily plug into the OBD port. That would be, you know, I mean, we need that for diagnostics.
I got you.
Yeah, they need that so that you can tell you got a bad oxygen sensor, you've got something wrong, and the electronics can tell you what's going on with any of the sensors.
It's funny to use that example. That's exactly what he found with it once on mine was the O2 sensor.
Yeah.
Okay, so it would plug into the or it would connect into the CAN bus, and then in that little unit that you've plugged into my car, it's got all these smarts about being able to talk to the roadside devices and other cars.
Right.
Okay.
The only challenge with them today, and I've held these units in my hand, they're about $2,200 today. We're never going to plug them in at this. Mm-hmm. Well, you got to figure, we're in the position where Moore's Law is going to kick in, and they'll be under $500 in about, you know, year and a half.
Yeah,
right?
But somebody with a car that old being able to shell out $500, that's still, I mean, unless it's a law, that's going to be a lot of money.
Well, they envision that within, you know, the next 10 years, you'll just be able to go down to Target and buy one like you'd buy a Wi-Fi access point, and they'd be the same kind of price range. That's what they're figuring. It's going to come down. This is economies of scale right now. We don't have enough of them being built, and they're expensive to build.
Yeah, yeah. Well, then that should start to work. You could even do government subsidies based on the savings from people cracking up on highways all the time and that kind of thing, right?
Oh, exactly. But I think you're going to find that because they haven't got the pipeline cranking these chips out all day, that's why we're in these high prices. They're all kind of custom, and they're still in testing. But there's a lot of testing going on. The guys at Virginia Tech Transportation Institute have about 400 researchers. Texas A&M Transport Research Institute have about 700 researchers on this. We've got transportation research going on all over the place. Ann Arbor's been involved in a big transportation pilot with USDOT, trying to figure out for about a year how does this stuff work, and trying to do tests. And you know, they install the unit in the car, and then the people drive around for a bit, and then they came back and gathered a whole bunch of information. So it's been really, really interesting, and it's real world tested.
Cool. So how far away are we from having these things? Are you giving me a big old tease? It's going to be 20 years before I can have all this?
No, not at all. Mary Barra, the CEO for General Motors, said that in 2 years, every Cadillac CTS is going to come with this built in.
Wow.
And she's going to connect 120 miles of roadway in the Detroit area as a proof of concept for these systems. But there's been real world testing going on already.
Now, Cadillacs are not the large volume of cars, right? What about your Hondas and your Toyotas?
Honda's working away at this too, and the Toyotas. I mean, there's representatives from lots of the manufacturers out at their the Belle Isle. They did a big demo ground, and they run the Detroit Grand Prix out there, so they had lots of roadway that they could just block off because they do it regularly. So they had the USDOT, the Virginia Transportation Tech Institute, Honda, a lot of different organizations out there doing demonstrations and tests of the systems. And this is coming to everybody. Anything that's going to run in Europe or North America is going to have this for sure. And we're working on the rest of the world. Looks like Japan is doing their own thing in terms of the frequencies they're using. They're the 700 megahertz range, but they're still going to be implementing it. I don't know how we're going to get electronic toll collection over here. I know that's huge in Japan for paying for roads, but this is all coming, and we're going to see a lot more about it. And that's why I wanted to share it with the Nocilla Castaways.
Yeah. Yeah. How far away is the part where I'm not going to get in traffic accidents anymore because I'm going to know that the guy in front of me is not paying attention and he's come over the line?
Well, blind spot warnings are available on the system today. And they demonstrated that. So I was in a USDOT Infiniti they tricked out. Mm-hmm. And it's loud and clear that there's a warning that, you know, if you are going to try and do a lane drift and there's a car that's in your blind spot, it warns you. And if you persist, it really warns you. You get, instead of just an amber light, you get horn and everything else going, that red lights. And it lets you really, it's irritated with you if you're trying to crash into somebody.
So I'm a little bit bothered by hearing that as being big news, because the company I worked for was for a period of time owned by General Motors, and Steve actually had the opportunity to ride in a vehicle that had we did a lot of antenna technology stuff in our company, and so they combined up with General Motors to work on some things like they had a unit called NODS, the Near Obstacle Detection System. You know, got to have an acronym for it. And this exactly. thing would do exactly what you're talking about. He said that they were driving along. They were going, you know, 65 miles an hour. Excuse me. And the driver moved the car behind someone who was going slower, and the car actually slowed down automatically. And this was, oh, man, at least 10 years ago. At least 10 years ago. And we had a thing that when you went to back up, it had a little antenna system that would tell you that there was a kid's tricycle behind your car. And so maybe you don't want to really drive over that kind of thing. And yet we're still talking about it like it's come right around the corner.
Well, I think it's more right around the corner than it has ever been. I can't say
now.
That. I'm sorry?
I want it now.
Well, we all want it right now. And like I said, there's we're going to have to get a critical mass number of vehicles out there before it really makes a ton of sense. But with the Cadillac making that groundbreaking announcement that it's coming as standard equipment in 2 years.
But only standard equipment on Cadillacs.
Well, the Cadillac CTS particularly, but...
But what about every other car they make?
They wanted to start somewhere.
Yeah, but... groundbreaking that one model of one car manufacturer is going to have it in 2 years.
Well,
it's not
you're
fast
start,
enough. You're just teasing me here.
Well, the thing is that you're going to be hearing about this. You're going to be hearing a lot more about this. And people don't know about connected vehicles really at all. They've been hearing all the splash, like you said, about our autonomous vehicles, the Googles of the world. And there's a lot of other folks working very diligently at getting those autonomous vehicles to function. This group really wants to make them automated vehicles where they're communicating with everybody else and they're playing on the same field and able to do some of the other things. I mean, we want to get into the whole wave thing where it's, okay, let's get the infotainment in the back seat too. Let's share out internet connections. Let's get traffic information and the higher level stuff besides just the, oops, I'm going to smash into something. So they're starting with the, let's get the crashes down and let's get this going that way.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They're going to have little units that go on your belt. So if you're a construction, you know, a road construction worker or an EMS, you know, an emergency responder of some kind, you'd have that. And that would help prevent any incidents from, you know, fire or police or you know, emergency personnel from having
incidents too.
That's
a really good idea for their safety.
They've been really thinking about this. There's a lot of work going on. And it's just an amazing situation.
I think that these things are not out of... I would say they're in concert together, though, that it seems to me that if we're working on self-driving cars and on autonomous vehicles that have a lot of intelligence and provide intelligence to the driver and situational awareness, those aren't out of sync to me, is that you could eventually, if you get to self-driving cars, you can also be combining in all this other information as information that the self-driven car also needs to know, right?
Absolutely.
The self-driving car needs to know that there's ice on that corner.
Exactly.
Needs to know there's a construction worker, you know, leaned over with his fanny out in the lane, you know. That'd be good information to have, I would think, either way.
Well, I think we do need to get there. And this is an initial step. I'm seeing that there is enough groundswell of activity that they're actually going to get somewhere with it now. We have sections of roadway that were connected this way. There's a loop out in front of Cobalt Hall that has been done with 17 roadside units. There's a stretch of Telegraph Road. up near Redford that is all connected now. So the systems are going out there. There's a whole section of roadway that's out in Ann Arbor area that's tricked out this way. Transportation management needs to be able to plug in and get some information out of this so that they can figure out how to provide better information and better planning. They're actually going to have...
I've just been thinking about the cars. You're right. Every single road has to be tricked out, right?
Well, from a roadside unit standpoint, it sure does. And that's what the next build out of this is going to be. So they're actually going to... They've got the MDOT, the Michigan Department of Transport, are in working in conjunction with their snow removal crews. And they're actually identifying with GPS and with inertial sensors for... You know, like we would have in your phone, that kind of thing, when they find a pothole. So now they can actually plot the potholes when they're in the middle of the winter time. They don't have to do a search to go out and find them. So they can actually respond somebody quicker to try and repair a pothole because they've got it on the charts.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. This stuff is a lot more intricate and interconnected than you can imagine.
Yeah. Well, this has been really, really interesting. I'm glad you came on, especially when you're so excited about it. If you find out that some big advances, some big steps get made, and you want to come back and tell us more about it, I think people would really, really get something out of it. It's fun to think about the future, and I feel bad for yelling at you that I want it now when I just finished saying, yeah, but they need to take the time to get the standards right. But I still want it now.
We all want it now, Allison. I think that's the whole problem. And when we started to look at it, the European Union was going a slightly different direction than the North American, and the folks in Asia were going a different direction. It was just, oh, are you kidding me? We can't pick one. Mm. Well, I guess the answer is no, and that's just going to make it a little bit more difficult to implement. And our system has got to work a little different than the system in Europe. And your case is exactly right. It's population densities. There's things that are going on. And there's other incumbents in the radio space, too. We've got primary radar in 5.9, and we have to do dynamic frequency shifting. They don't have that in Europe. So it's just it's way, way intricate and involved, and it's just not simple.
Yeah. Well, and you got to get it right. Because if you don't get it right, people die. So it's tricky stuff, right?
That's exactly it.
Well, I sure hope they're successful bringing those crash rates down. Those are appalling statistics. And thank you so much for volunteering to come on. This was really cool. Very, very interesting stuff.
Well, thank you very much, Allison. And I hope you all think that this was an idea worth sharing.
All right. I love that he ended with that line. That's a great, great tagline. You know, I neglected to ask Ian for contact details. If you want to follow him, probably the best way to do it is on Google+. He's simply Ian Douglas, and there's a link in the show notes to that. And if you want to email him, it is 4iandouglas@gmail.com. That's the number 4, Ian Douglas, iandouglas@gmail.com. And of course, there are links in the show notes to all of that. But that's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsor for helping to pay the bills. Head on over to BlueMangoLearning.com, makers of Clarify. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions. We've been getting a lot of good questions lately. Allison@podfeet.com. You can follow me on Twitter and app.net at Podfeet. And the NoSilicast Google+ community has broken through the barrier of 400 members. I'm telling you, when I get stuck, I go over to the Google+ community and I post over there. I just posted a question today. I'm looking for a backup drive for my daughter, and I know somebody's going to give me the answer. Might be George from Tulsa, because he is a really active member out there, knows a lot of stuff about drives. It should be really fun. So, and don't forget to stop over to iTunes and drop that press a button there and leave a little review. Really help out the show. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, I believe this was the first time good friend of the show, Leon, has ever come to the live show. If you want to do like he did, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic NoSilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.